You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening, and welcome to the Open Society Institute and to this panel presentation on Exposing Statelessness, Understanding the Plight of Burma's Rohingya. The panel that we're going to deal with today is quite a wide-ranging group of experts on various different issues. We've got experts on Burma. We've got people demonstrating how photography can be used as part of an NGO campaign to bring attention to a particular problem. We've got medical experts. We've got legal experts. We've got NGO experts and people from the United Nations within the audience. And so it's a rather broad range of discussion that we're going to have. So that probably means that we may not be able to get into quite as much depth as we might do in any one of the individual subjects, but hopefully the breadth of it will make it much more interesting. We have quite a limited period of time to deal with this panel. We're hoping that we'll spend about 1 hour with the panelists here by asking them a series of questions, and then we'll be able to open it up to the audience at the end of that for about half an hour. But it does mean that the questions that come from the floor will have to be shortened to the point so that we can get in as many as possible during the course of that 1 half-hour session. If I may, I'll start by introducing our panelists. On the far left, we have Richard Solomon, who is the Director of Research and Investigations for Armed Conflict and Public Health at Physicians for Human Rights. He has recently been involved in publishing a report on the situation of the Rohingya in one particular unofficial camp in Bangladesh, and he's going to be describing to you the effects of that. To his right, we have Mong Tun Kin, who is a Rohingya who left Burma in 2004 and from since then has been living in the United Kingdom, where he has set up the Burmese Rohingya Organization of the UK, BRUK, if that's how you pronounce the acronym, not quite sure, who is going to be able to speak to us about his activities raising awareness of the problem of the Rohingya as a stateless population in both Burma and in Bangladesh. Next, we have Saiful Huq Omi, whose photographs are appearing behind him. He is a photographer who has been working as a photographer since 2005 and has recently undertaken a project photographing the Rohingya inside refugee camps in Bangladesh, which are featured in the OSI exhibition Moving Walls, which opens on June the 2nd upstairs. Unfortunately, we can't let you upstairs to see those photographs today due to various complications, but you've got them here, and he's going to be speaking about some of the photographs and the stories behind them later on during the session. And lastly, on my left is Maureen Ong Phuin, who is the director of the Burma Project of the Southeast Asia Initiative here at the Open Society Institute. So those are our panel, and perhaps if you can give them a welcome to this event this evening. So I'm going to turn first to Tun Kin, who can tell us what it is like to be Rohingya and the problems that that particular ethnic group have faced. And can I ask you to start by perhaps describing to the audience your story? How did you end up leaving Burma, and how did you end up in the United Kingdom?
Actually, first of all, I would like to say thank you very much to all of my friends to join in this event. And I was born and brought up in Arakan State and Buthidong Township. And after I passed my O level, I left to Rangoon, which is former capital of Burma now, illegally, as we cannot move from one village to another. We cannot move from one town to another town. So I left to Rangoon capital in 2000, and after that I have committed to work for our community, our Rohingya people who have been suffering a long time and facing such a human rights violation amount. So I did some work with Rohingya ethnic activists in Rangoon and some NLD youth group in Rangoon actually, and after that I was interrogated and I left from Burma in 2004. I left to Thailand, and after that I came to London in 2004 March.
And it may be an obvious question, but why did you have to leave in 2004?
Firstly, in Burma, whoever involved in politics, they are interrogated by military regime. And for being Rohingya, that is more worse. Because of being Rohingya, we are facing persecution as being Muslim, and we are politically and ethnically facing persecution in Burma. So that is more worse. So if they found me, I may be even killed. That's what I worried.
Some of the audience may not know the history of Rohingya in particular. Can you briefly describe who they are and how they are different from other groups within Burma?
Well, Rohingyas are one of the ethnic minority in Burma. They have been living early 7th century AD. The ancestors are from Arabs, Mughals, and Bengalis. And they are about 1.3 million Rohingya population in Burma, and 1.5 million have left out of the country because of continued persecution, such as they facing denial of citizenship and restriction on movement, restriction on marriage, restriction on education, confiscation of lands, rape, Rohingya women, and extrajudicial killings are going on.
Can I ask you how the Rohingya are different to other peoples within Burma?
Well, Rohingyas are actually, during democratic period, Rohingyas are recognized as an ethnic minority of Burma, equal to other nationalities. And even my grandfather, whose name is Mr. Abdul Ghaffar, and he is a parliamentary secretary during democratic period, 1950 to 1962. But today, I am as a foreigner in Burma. I'm not a citizen of Burma. I'm not even an ethnic. I'm a foreigner. I left. That's the way from Burma. My grandfather was a parliamentary secretary. You can imagine how situation we are. And actually, my name is Ziaul Ghaffar, which is my Muslim name, because I couldn't use in Burma because of discrimination.
And obviously, as Muslims, that's a particular distinction compared to the rest of the majority population in Burma.
Exactly, yeah. Military regime have planned for Rohingya systematic persecution, and it is ethnic cleansing. They have intention to get rid of Rohingya Muslims of Arakan. That is what they are planning, and they are implementing day by day. From 1962 until today, we are facing such a human rights violation different from other ethnic minority of Burma.
And so the expulsions began in the 1960s and then in the 1970s?
1962, after General Ne Win coup the power, it was started actually.
And then the next incident, I think, in 1978?
Yeah, they started in 1962, they plan slowly, systematically, they going on. In 1978, what they did is a Nagamen operation, which is called Dragon Operation. And that operation is what they did. Their plan is to collect the IDs, and they gone around all the Rohingya houses, and they try to collect it up the ID cards. And they took ID cards and they look at it, they say, no, this is something wrong, you have to provide another one. And that's the way they did. And some of the Rohingyas, they don't have ID cards. And the regime, the people from immigration, they asking, where is your grandfather from and where is your father from? Can you show me his ID?
Right.
Most of the people, they don't have actually his grandfather's ID at all. Who gonna collect it? So some people, they scare and they drive, they gone to Bangladesh.
Right. And in 1982, there's a new Citizenship Act, which changes the status of Rohingya in Burma.
Exactly, yeah.
And how does that change? What's the problem that's caused by that new act?
Actually, that 1982 citizenship law is designed for Rohingyas. That law deprive Rohingyas as deprive us basic fundamental human rights, and that law made us de facto stateless in our own homeland.
And I think the details of the law is that it lists a number of ethnic groups who may be citizens, and Rohingya are not included in that list, so they are de facto excluded from becoming citizens.
Exactly. Okay. And what they mention is that citizenship law was mentioned, Rohingyas or whoever, especially Rohingyas, they need to show up that your grandfather is living here before 1823. So we will recognize you as a citizen. So most of the people, they have been living here a long time, as like my grandfather was a parliamentary secretary, and his grandfather was there, and so he couldn't get his grandfather ID on that time. That time the world is not like today, not improved, not developed, so it's very hard. So when they can't provide anything, and after that they collected back your IDs and they arrest you, and some people were arrested and other people gone back to Bangladesh to cross the border, because there is no justice for Rohingyas in our Arakan state, in Burma even.
Can I ask about life for Rohingyas in Burma today without an ID card, unable to prove who they are? From your experience before 2004 and your knowledge of people you speak to now, how does that affect their everyday lives?
Yeah, even for me, what I face is I saw the people, how the students, they couldn't get education.
Why not?
Because you can't provide ID card. You don't have ID. How can you go to university and colleges? Even some higher school. If you want to sit for O-level matriculation, which is called 10th standard, you need to provide your ID card. Without that ID, you can't sit for 10th standard O-level examination. But still, that is a bit easier to provide some bribes.
He did it.
So
how did you do that?
Provide some bribes. And
right.
This is not too strict for 10th standard, but university is really worse. Whoever have permitted to go to university, like some student who got fourth distinction or five distinctions, very high marks, and they were, when they applied for university, they were allowed to come for University of Medicine in capital of Burma, but when they go to that the invitation letter to Village Peace and Development Council, they don't give you a permission, because you are not allowed, you are not a citizen of Burma. You can't go to those kind of universities. Even sometimes the way they mention that you are foreigners, you guys are not allowed to go to capital of Burma.
Right. And so it affects their freedom of movement within Burma. How does it affect their ability to work?
Oh, that is totally different from other place of Burma. You can imagine, like Rohingyas who are living in Arakan state. For example, let's say this is 57th Street. From 59th Street to, if you want to go to Queens, you have to apply for you have to fill up a form and you have to give some bribe. Even if you provide bribe, it takes 2 days. So you need to get a permission. So, like, you can imagine how can go from, like, here, from New York to New Jersey. He can't go at all. So you need to provide a bribe. So that is the way Rohingyas are facing their daily life today. I believe there is no other people in this world what Rohingyas are facing today. Even I have been faced that thing, and it was really long for me to come to Rangoon. About 6 months I have been waiting and try to provide bribe through some agents, and finally I was left out. I'm very lucky. So like me, a lot of people there who are interested to work for the community, who want to get education like me. So today they are still in Arakan. They are without any helpless. So their life is really worse. Some people from Arakan state, they call me up and they telling me, please let the world know how we are facing today, what is our situation.
How does it affect their ability to own land? That's often a key problem with stateless populations. How did it affect the Rohingya in Burma?
Confiscation of lands is the ending point to become a refugee. Actually, what they do, firstly, the restriction of movement, that they deny citizenship, and still some people provide bribe, very little people, like maybe 1%. And restriction of movement, marriage, restriction on education, still people do not leave from the country because outside wall, Rohingya, they can't get that much protection. But finally, when their lands was confiscated, they left out of the country, crossing the border to Bangladesh. And after they confiscated the lands, they put under of military control. Mm-hmm. And they call up from upper side of Burma, non-Rohingyas, they settle there. That are actually, nowadays, even 3-4 months ago, they have seized about southern part of Butidong, which is our western part of Burma, Arakan state. 3,000 houses of lands they confiscated, and they put some pools there. And so those people, they can't do anything on that lands. So they brought some non-Rohingyas, which are old prisoners. They are very cruel people, and they provide them the lands there. And so that people, they live in there, and that villagers need to provide for them the food. And sometimes, whatever villagers they want, they need to provide. And what they do is they try to rape Rohingya women. And 4-5 months ago, one Rohingya woman was raped, was very badly. By authorities. How is normally Rohingyas villages, the police come, the military, they come to our village and they try to look for the man to force labor or to ask some money. So, and her husband was at home, and the police came to her his house, and when he saw it far away from far, and he was left out the back side of the door, and the police met his wife, and he was asking from his wife, "Where is your husband?" And she said, "She's gone to some. He have gone to somewhere else." And said, "No, you are lying." And after that, try to take her, and about five, somebody expecting, thinking that it's six, policemen have been raped her continuously. So, and the lady was, after one day, the lady was passed away. And Rohingya women, they are very shy, and she didn't tell to her husband. And finally find out, she was died straight away, and couldn't, she can't explain anything, and nobody, there's no justice at all for her. I'm so sympathy for her because she's from nearby to my village, my town. So this is the way today Rohingya women have been facing in Arakan state.
And what kind of investigation occurs where there are crimes like that against the community?
As authorities, nobody can go and talk to authorities being Rohingyas. If you go there, you will get even arrested. So it's better to keep quiet for all of them. That's the way they are. If you want to leave, you can talk. But some people, they quarrel with police, and they just straight away left out of the country, right, same day.
And another problem that stateless individuals have is the stages of life. What happens when a child is born in the Rohingya community, or people want to get married? How's the lack of citizenship affect that?
Yeah, well, this, when Rohingya, they have to get married, they need to apply a form, which take like 2 years, some are 3 years. If you can provide like big bribe, like which is 500,000 chats, which is like $500. So they will provide you within 1 year. Otherwise, your application will take like 2 years, 3 years. So people, some people, they can't wait, and they married, they gone
they were sentenced to jail. And when they married, they need to apply, they need to sign declaration, I will take only two children. So that is the way they have to do. And today, some Rohingyas who were married without permission, secretly, because they can't wait for 2 years, their husband and they have been in, husband and wife, so they can't wait for 2 years and they get married, those people have been arrested and sentenced to jail 4 to 5 years. And that was even recent Thomas Container report have been mentioned. In Butidong jail, there is more than, we have, from our reliable source, we heard there's more than 300 prisoners there. But he didn't mention exactly how many, but most of the prisoners are because of marriage. They were arrested, they were sentenced. So this is a silent killing field for Rohingya people. Wherever they can, they just try to get rid of these people, systematically eliminating.
So can I ask, given that perilous situation you've described, how are you working with your organization, Brook, to try and raise the issue of Rohingya in the international environment?
Yes. After I came to UK, I have been committed for my community to work for my people. So we are a few Rohingyas there we that time, but now more than we have 50 or 60 members. So on that time we were organized and we tried to found an organization which is now we call Burmese Rohingya Organization UK. It was founded for the aim of the objective of to raise awareness of Rohingya people, how Rohingya people are facing today in Arakan state. Like even MSF have been mentioned, Rohingyas are one of the world 10 dangers of extinction. And also, you know, like one of the high official, UN official mentioned, who have been served in Darfur and Somalia, those kind of places, he say, he knows how human misery in Arakan state. This is the place he have never seen how basic freedoms are denied in Arakan state. So we have totally, our feelings are there, so we are committed. We just, as I'm leading as a president of organization, and we are trying to raise awareness and to work with the ethnic people of Burma and democratic forces of Burma for the future Federal Union of Burma, to form a future Federal Union of Burma, and also to promote human rights and democracy for Burma with all democratic forces, and to work to uplift education for the Rohingya community.
Thank you. Now, we'll come back to you later, I think.
Thank you so much.
More about the work that you're doing and how it ties in with everything else.
Sure.
I'm going to move across now to push forward to Omi, who has looked at one of the large movements out of Burma, that is a large movement of Rohingya into Bangladesh, and by photographing their lives there and experiencing what their lives are like for, I think, a period of about 3 months. He's documented the photographs you've been seeing, the way that they live their lives there. Can I ask you to describe how it is you came about to end up taking these photographs of the Rohingya?
Thank you for inviting me here. It's an honor and it's a great opportunity to share what I have seen and I've been watching there in the camps. I'm still working on the project and I'll be continuing for another year or so. I was having another exhibition in Dhaka. Dhaka is the capital city. So it was funded by the Dutch embassy. It was a 10-day exhibition. I still remember on the 8th day, the ambassador came back and she requested me that I should go to the camps. As anyone in Bangladesh, you know, like Bangladesh, I knew about the Rohingyas from TV, from news and everyone else. So I decided to go there. And as soon as my exhibition ended, I went there. And I still remember how I felt. One of the camps are called Kutu Palong, and anyone from Bangladesh need a official permission from the government. So I contacted UNHCR, who has been supporting my work since. to give me a letter of permission from the manager, permission letter from the government, and I went inside the camp. And I worked for 200, 300 years, and I immediately felt that I have to do something here. Whoever funds it, if there is an assignment or whatever. The reason that I felt, reason I felt like this was, it is something personal. A large part of my family in 1971 war, we had our war in 1971 with Pakistan. A large part of my family was refugee. I was born much later, the war ends, but I grew up with these stories from my father, from my parents, from my uncles. They used to tell me stories about how it is to be a refugee. And those were just words, those were just stories. When I walked into Kutupalong camp, I felt this is it. This is how my mother felt. This is how my family lived their life in the camps. And, you know, Bangladesh probably has the largest number of refugees since a long time. It was like 10 million of them went to India. So whenever we talk about our own war, we talk about our refugee history. So that is what actually touched my heart, and I decided to do it.
Are the photographs all taken in the one camp or the
two of the camps?
Two of them, all right.
I wanted to document the third camp, which is called the Leda camp, an unregistered camp. But what happens, I went inside and I was there for probably 15, 20 minutes. And within 20 minutes, I'm telling this just to so that you understand the situation better. I was surrounded by 10 policemen. In a way, they arrested me. Not arrested me, they said, put down your camera, put it in the bag, and you have to go to the camp. And so I wasn't allowed.
Right.
So this is the situation. I'm a Bangladeshi photographer. I know people, but it didn't help.
And what period of time did it take to complete this part of the project?
Approximately 3-4 months, yeah. I actually, what I do, I always, as a photographer, I go in, stay there, listen to stories. If I'm happy, then stay there longer, come back, edit down. So it was like 3-4 months.
Right. I'm going to put up a couple of the photographs. And that's great. Can you tell us the story of this one? How did that come about, and what does it show?
Yeah. I don't speak the Rohingya language, so it's pretty much the same as our Chittagongian dialect. So I have to have a guide with me. His name is Abul Kashim, the guy that you are looking at, the silhouette figure. We started working very early in the morning. We always do that. We work the whole day. And it was the time of the sunset, and sun was setting, and we were actually waiting for the bus to come and pick us up. And then we were just simply walking. I still remember the time. And then he said that, let's walk by the side of the river. The name of the river is called Naf. And we were walking by the side of the river. And sun was setting down. Nobody was around. As far as you can see, nobody. Me and him. So that was the silent moment. And suddenly I was trying to take some photographs, and I was down there, and as you can see, he was pointing towards something. I looked back and I said, what you're saying? He said, can you see on the other side of the river? I said, yeah, it's just a few probably a kilometer, something like that. He said, that's where my home is, and I was born there, and I can never cross the river and go back there. Maybe it's just 2 kilometers, but it is indeed 2 million miles, which I will never be able to cross. And that's where my mother is. That's where my family is. But I will never go back. That's what he said.
I think there's another one. What are we seeing here? Which, I think this is probably part of the camp.
Yeah, it's called the makeshift camps outside the Kutupalong camp. The just beside the official registered people. This is the makeshift camps. I was photographing people, and all the time we walked and, you know, trying to find stories and trying to photograph people. This young child.
How long has that camp been there?
Sorry?
How long has that camp been in existence?
Since 1991. Okay. Yeah. So the camp was, one part of our project was to teach children how to take pictures. So I was with the children all the time. This girl, particularly this girl, was not part of the project, but I was talking to children, knowing how they feel about their life. So I was crossing, and I saw this kid playing, and I took the photograph. Then, as a regular question, I asked her what's her name and how does she feel and things like that. I asked her, how do you feel being in the camp? Because when you talk to some older people, you know, mature people, they would always say, complain about things, that they're here, they're not allowed to work, they don't know when they will be going back and things like that. But when you talk to children, when you talk to people, you know, these kind of girls and boys, they would talk in a very different way. They would just say, life is beautiful here. And this girl in particular said something which is, I think, is very important to understand. She said, I don't understand why my father and those older people always complain. Life is pretty beautiful here. I love this place and I want to stay here forever. And this is, I think, what is very different from us to them. For them, this is the world. They haven't seen anything better than it in their life. They think living in a camp is natural. They think not being a citizen of somewhere is natural. They think life is this, because they can't compare their life with anyone else. Most of the time, they cannot go out of the camps. Most of the time, they're spending time doing nothing. And they are not allowed, since very recently, they're not allowed to go to schools and things. They have accepted it, taken for granted. This is life. And that's what it is for the children.
Thank you. The panelists got a picture they'd like to pick out, or any questions they've got for Omi?
The one photo that I really loved, because it, so many of the human rights violations, without really knowing that those are human rights violations, is the one of the child carrying the wood on his head. Is that in there?
Not a young child, that's a man.
That's a man.
Yeah.
Oh, I meant the other one with the stack, a bundle of wood. Sure. I was just going to say, because so many people at these refugee camps, especially the unofficial camps that Kutupalong belong or spend some time, their only means of earning an income these days is collecting firewood. And why is that a human rights violation? Well, because they have to leave the camp, they're exposed to arbitrary arrest anytime that they step foot out of this unofficial camp. The women and girls are subject to rape once they leave the camp, searching for this firewood. So when I saw that picture, I immediately saw, oh my gosh, there are so many human rights violations captured in this one photograph. It's on the slideshow on your website, but it's a stunning photograph nonetheless.
Yeah, I think, yes. Human rights violation is horrible there. And, you know, these stories, the reason, one of the reason I did this project or doing this project is because I'm a journalist, I'm a photographer, and I have to follow news. And whenever you watch TV, whenever you read the newspaper in Bangladesh, these are the people who are represented as devils, as monsters. These are the people, they say, are responsible of whatever bad happens in Cox's Bazar, the district that they are in. They are called rapists, they are called smugglers, they are called whatever. So this is always a one-sided story, as if they are the worst possible people on the face of this earth. So that made me curious. When I read this stuff, see these photographs and things, you know, beyond anything else, you just feel curious. How could a large community of people, as he just mentioned, 3 million of them, we probably have around 500,000 of them in Bangladesh, can become criminals. How could that be? How could that very child can become a criminal? It can't be. It's not possible. So I decided to go in. I decided to understand the situation. And the violation that happens, human rights violation, the kind of violence that you see and know that is happening against the Rohingyas, and also they're not just the victims. What is very depressing, that when a large community of people lives under such situations that they don't have any hopes, life no more remains simple. They have also become very violent. They have also been very violent to their own people. I have photographed, interviewed stories within the camps where there are police patrols, where there are supposed to be all sort of securities. The sort of violence that is happening, that's horrible. And yeah, it's not a good situation.
Now, I know someone in the audience had a question about the use of photographs and videos as part of campaigning on an issue, but I think we'll save that one for the question session at the end, if we can.
Can I ask Omi a question? You said you didn't, you know, Bangladeshis in general don't know much about it, and they demonize, right?
Yeah.
The refugees. How have you found, have you talked about this? Have you had this kind of show in Bangladesh? And do people understand if they don't go themselves to the refugee camps? Which I doubt if most people would.
Yeah, the thing is, first of all, I had an exhibition organized by UNHCR on the 20th of June last year. People came in, and what I felt from their reaction, they said that to me, that we didn't know this is happening. Exactly, that is what he said. And again, about demonizing and things, I think there is a reason behind it. In particular, to be very subjective, the kind of politics that we have in Bangladesh, especially on that part, that's a border region. So a lot of smugglings and arms, ammunition smugglings, drugs, and many things are happening there. As many of the powerful people, I repeat, many of the powerful people are doing it themselves, they need a scapegoat. They need someone to blame. And the Rohingyas are there to be blamed. So that's the reason it is happening like that.
I'm going to pull us out briefly from the specifics of the Rohingya to look at the issue of statelessness, because unfortunately this is only an example of many different countries where this problem happens. And I'm going to play a quick 2-minute video, which has James Goldston, who's the Executive Director of the Open Society Justice Initiative, and we are currently involved in litigating cases of statelessness in 8 countries around the world, to various regional human rights and UN human rights bodies. And this explains some of the problems that this case demonstrates, as well as others. Hopefully it'll say.
You'll see.
Okay, let's leave the video, and hopefully it'll come back. And let's quickly look at, to answer the gentleman's question, which countries? So one of the ones we're obviously dealing with Burma, and the problem of the Rohingya there. Other examples of statelessness, they come from a variety of different issues. One is state succession, where states break apart from each other and populations end up stuck in the wrong country. And a particular example of that is in the Baltic states, where in Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania you had large numbers of Russians left there who didn't have citizenship rights after the split up of the Soviet Union, which caused great problems. Slovenia is another good example, where they erased over 100,000 citizens because they didn't apply within 6 months to become citizens of Slovenia. They suddenly were stateless. That caused a real problem. There are other problems that are caused by wars. In Mauritania, one ethnic group essentially pushed out an ethnic group, and the black Mauritanians were pushed south into the neighboring countries as part of a civil war process. And despite a judgment from the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, we are currently involved in trying to implement that decision with UNHCR to have the Mauritanians return back to Mauritania when they were thrown out. Other examples of ethnic distinctions are in Kenya, where the Kenyan Nubians, originally from Sudan, brought by the British colonial army in about 1904, have been living in Kibera, the slum of Kibera near Nairobi, for over 100 years, but the Kenyan government isn't sure whether they're citizens or not. That means they can't get ID cards, and the problems you've heard about the Rohingya are exactly the same for the Kenyan Nubians. They can't vote, they can't travel, they can't get jobs, they can't go to school, so they live in total poverty, completely marginalized, living in the largest slum in Africa. Another example that's slightly more unusual is the Roma within Europe. We've just taken on a new case for a Roma man in Italy, who was born in Italy, but his parents are from the former Yugoslavia. Serbia won't recognize him as a citizen, neither will Croatia, and under the new Berlusconi laws on illegal migrants, he is now a criminal because he can't prove his citizenship status. So he's attempting to have himself declared stateless so that he isn't sent to prison, which is a completely ridiculous situation in a European country. So that's available on the OSI website, which gives you some examples of the different places where it's occurred. And let me have another go now and see whether we can make that video work. It wasn't very long. There it is. Ah, I think we can have another go. It's only 2 minutes. Worth seeing.
Citizenship has been said to be the right to have rights. It's the essential foundation of your legal identity, of your. Being a citizen is often essential to basic things like housing, health care, education, the kinds of things that everybody needs in order to live a decent human life. Statelessness has been around as long as citizenship. A problem whereby people are not recognized as citizens by any state. So they have no home. They don't have a birth certificate. They don't have any legal identity card, and they can't get it. It's really hard for them to get it, or the government makes it impossible for them to get it. Many stateless persons are living where they have lived all their lives and where their parents have lived all their lives. They have fundamental problems, but they have never crossed a border. Statelessness causes people not to be able to go to school. It has health impact because they can't get health care. It has economic impact because they can't get a job. And it has a human security impact because people who are stateless are more vulnerable to violence. But even beyond those terrible human aspects, at an individual level, we've seen repeatedly that statelessness is a source of armed conflict. Everyone is threatened, so we all have an interest in ensuring human security and citizenship for everyone. Citizenship is integral to open society. All persons have a right to participate in the communities where they live, and stateless persons are denied that right. We need to do a better job of ensuring that laws make it easy and accessible for people to become citizens, and make it hard for states to deny or deprive people of citizenship.
Patience in me getting it working, but hopefully that illustrates the scale of the problem and the way that these things we've just been hearing about affect many more populations around the world. Now let's move back down again to the Rohingya, and I think we'll move to the population outside the country and the condition of the camps in Bangladesh, and we'll move across to Richard Solom, who has, as I explained earlier, has recently been involved in drafting a report for Physicians for Human Rights describing the health conditions in one of these camps. Can I ask you, just to help some of the audience may not know exactly what you do with PHR, can you give a bit of background about Physicians for Human Rights?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much to OSI for having this presentation and slideshow on focusing on the Rohingya, which is a critically important issue, and also for inviting Physicians for Human Rights to participate. Physicians for Human Rights is an independent, non-governmental organization based in Boston, where it was founded in 1986 by a group of physicians affiliated with Harvard Medical School. And these physicians got together in the mid-1980s, and they saw that there was a link between health and human rights, which may seem pretty obvious now, but about 25 years ago, that was pretty cutting edge in the human rights movement. And they saw that they had a specific skill set with their medical and public health degrees and backgrounds to document human rights violations. So very early on, PHR was instrumental in documenting the health effects of, for example, torture. Then in the mid-1990s, we became involved with the criminal tribunals, gathering forensic evidence from the mass graves in Rwanda and Yugoslavia, and supplying that evidence, looking at bones, for example, archaeologists and forensic anthropologists unearthing these bodies, part of the genocide in those two countries, and giving over this forensic evidence to the ad hoc criminal tribunals. So that's our history. We now have a program on armed conflict, looking at human rights abuses there, which I lead. And this specifically is using public health skills, specifically epidemiologic skills, to document human rights violations. For example, crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, in places and in times of conflict.
And out of all the options of things that you could focus your attention on, how did you come to focus on the Rohingya camps?
Actually, that came about from a larger project. So I'm involved in a two-year study looking at crimes against humanity across Burma in four ethnic states, the Chin state, Shan, Karen, and the Arakan state. And so we're doing a random sample of about 3,000 households, families across Burma. Our hypothesis is that crimes against humanity are being perpetrated by the military junta, and we are setting out to do that scientifically and to show that indeed crimes against humanity are widespread and systematic. So I was in Mizoram, India, which is north of Bangladesh, training people to go inside Burma to conduct this research, and afterwards I was going down to Bangladesh to work with our Burmese community-based organizations, colleagues, and partners to do phase two in Arakan State, and that was in February of this year. I'd also been there in October to set up the logistics. In any event, I was there. We started doing in-depth qualitative interviews with a doctor colleague and I, and we were in the four camps, the two official and two unofficial camps. And I started doing the interviews, you know, normal kind of 90, 120 minute in-depth interviews where you ask repeated questions and you go over and over and you try to ask the same question from a different angle to basically you're investigating, you're trying to get the person to mess up. So, but if they tell a very coherent and logical and chronological story and they keep telling the same consistent story with details, you know, that becomes a good story. Well, I kept trying to get information about human rights violations ongoing in Arakan State, speaking with the Rohingya. And these were recently arrived refugees who were in these camps. And all that they were focusing on was the human rights violations that were going on in Bangladesh. And this was the first day. And the first person that I spoke to was a 50-year-old widower, a woman who had arrived about 6 months prior. She had four children, and she was hard-pressed to focus on her life in Arakan State, which is what I was trying to get information about. And finally, I after the interview, I just turned to my colleague, Dr. Parmar, and I said, we need to do an emergency investigation here. We need to stay an extra week and look at the situation of forced expulsion of these people, of arbitrary arrests, of rape, of beatings by members of parliament against Rohingya who were there. I mean, the stories that we heard were quite astounding. And as a former UNHCR protection officer who's been in a number of refugee camps all over the world, the conditions that I saw specifically in the unofficial camp at Kutupalong were quite severe and, some of the worst conditions that I've ever seen.
Did you focus on one of the camps for the emergency report in full?
We did focus at that point on the unofficial camp because it was the largest. There was about 30,000 people who had arrived there for the most part over the past 2 years. Kutupalong unofficial camp, which is basically in the shape of a horseshoe, which surrounds the official camp of the same name, which is about an hour southeast of Cox's Bazar, near a town called Teknaf. And in any event, this unofficial camp grew in leaps and bounds over the past couple of years and kind of spread out from beyond the official camp. It doesn't mean that they're the same camps. They have the same name, but there is a big distinction between registered UNHCR-supported refugees who have the legal distinction of being called a refugee, you know, capital R, and then the other refugees, small r, who have fled Burma and who also have a well-founded fear of persecution, but who do not enjoy that legal status from the government. Because, as I'm sure you know, Bangladesh, along with many of the other countries in Southeast Asia, is not a signatory to the 51 Refugee Convention. So they don't technically or legally have to give rights accorded to these people because there has not been either a prima facie refugee status determination, prima facie means that it's given to a group of people, or individual status determination, because Bangladesh does not have a legal framework for determining who is and who is not a refugee. They just categorically call all of the Rohingya economic migrants.
And so up to a certain point, historically, Bangladesh was granting refugee status, and I've forgotten, what year did that change over?
It's true. It was up until about 1993. So in 91, 92, there was a mass influx of about 250,000 Rohingya who fled across the border into Bangladesh near Cox's Bazar, and there was a series of about 12 or 13 camps, refugee camps, which UNHCR administered for some time. But between 93 and 97, about 210,000 of those 250,000 returned, not voluntarily, but most of them were forcibly returned back into Arakan State. There was a small number, about 22,000 of whom were granted refugee status. And those are the same refugees who live there today, who live in the quote-unquote official camps that we've seen pictures of.
And what proportion are we saying are the official registered refugees?
There's about 28,000 official refugees who are Rohingya who live in the region, and the numbers range from anywhere from 200,000 to 500,000 Rohingya who are so-called self-settled, in other words, that they have settled voluntarily in the Bangladeshi community, in the small villages in this southeastern part of Bangladesh. No one knows the numbers because there's never been a census.
So what were your key findings from a medical perspective in this camp?
Well, if I could break up the two into our key findings had to do with protection issues, and then humanitarian issues. So first, protection. As I mentioned, we heard many accounts of forced expulsion. In legal terms, this is refoulement, refoulement. And that non-refoulement is a general principle in international law. It's a part of customary international law. It's non-derogable, meaning that a government, even if it's not state party to the 51 Convention or the 67 Protocol, that they must abide by this fundamental human right. It is the core of refugee law, and Bangladesh government is not respecting it. In other words, they are forcibly, the Bangladeshi police and the Bangladeshi rifles, the border security forces, are forcibly literally pushing across the Naf River that we saw a picture of, families on a daily basis. This is happening. So that's one major finding, that this is taking place. The second is that there are arbitrary arrests. So I talked about how the unofficial camp at Kutupalong has grown over the past couple of years from about 5,000 to about 30,000. Where are these people coming from? Well, they're not coming from directly from Arakan State. Yep. You know, tens and hundreds are still coming across the border into Bangladesh, but as you've heard from my colleagues, freedom of movement is not a right in Arakan State. It is very difficult to get out of Arakan State, and in fact, they're building a cement and barbed wire fence at the border. So it's very difficult to actually get out of Arakan State. So these refugees are coming from the villages where they've been living for 10, 15, 20 years, these self-settled refugees. And what caused the impetus over the past couple of years to come to these camp-like settings where you have congregations of people living together? Well, it was because the Bangladesh government started to systematically round up and forcibly expel the Rohingya back into Burma, Arakan State, and arbitrarily arrest them. So that caused panic and fear in the community, causing the Rohingya just to flee in all directions. They thought that they would find safety at the official camp at Kutupalong. When they got there, they realized that humanitarian agencies are forbidden by the Bangladesh government to give them any sort of humanitarian aid, especially even food aid. So they ended up, you know, being basically kicked out of where they've been living peacefully for the past 10, 20 years. And now they find themselves refugees, but without enjoying the status of refugee. And why is this status so important? It's because if you have this legal status, then you have access to the humanitarian community. You have access to humanitarian assistance, access to humanitarian food, which is what the 28,000 who are registered, who do have this legal status, do enjoy. I wish I could show you some pictures of the disparities that you can see quite readily between the official and unofficial camps. It is, you know, one looks like a refugee camp, which has elementary education and computer training courses and, you know, corrugated metal rooftops, which keeps the water out. And then the other camp is, you know, just makeshift huts built of ripped plastic and leaves and twigs that, you know, people are trying to live in. So in terms of protection, those were our findings. And the humanitarian issues, let me just point out one, which was malnutrition. We did an emergency study, a survey in two locations of the camp where the newest refugees had arrived, 40 in one part and 60 in another. And we actually did a census, which means that we went house to house and measured the mid-upper arm circumference of children between the ages of 6 months and 59 months. And this is the kind of the gold standard for measuring acute malnutrition in an emergency. It's basically that you slip this around the child's arm, measure it, and below 125 millimeters is acute malnutrition. And basically, this is the size of, this is what we talk about when we say acute malnutrition. It's skin and bones, and it's quite heartening. So some people say, well, you know, Rick, Bangladesh is a very poor country, and especially Cox's Bazar district. It's one of the poorest regions of Bangladesh. So, you know, isn't malnutrition very high among the Bangladesh people? Well, I'm sure it is. I'm sure that it is astronomically high, and it's, we would be surprised at, I'm sure, the figures. But the issue is that these are refugees who are stateless, and they don't have access to the humanitarian community. They don't have access to food aid. They are arrested if they step foot out of this unofficial camp. So they're basically locked in this camp. They're arrested if they leave. The international community is forbidden. They want to provide humanitarian assistance, but the Bangladesh government refuses. So this is why measuring malnutrition among a refugee population is quite different than measuring it and finding perhaps similar rates among the local population.
That report is, there's a web link to the email invitation you got sent, has a link to that report where people can download it and read it in full. Thank you very much. I'm going to move on finally to Maureen to look at what we can do about all of this to some extent. Can I ask to begin with what projects that OSI has done to support Rohingya activity and people attempting to bring attention to the plight of this particular stateless group?
We haven't done enough, but we have a few projects. We're funding a couple of new services. One, Narindra. It covers all of geographic Arakan, so it has some Rohingya news. But we also support something called the Kalandan Press Network. I mean, you can subscribe to all this online, and you'll get, you know, regular news. And we've supported NGOs in neighboring countries. I don't know if you remember last January, there was this huge, you know, there were some, the boatloads of Rohingyas who landed up in Thailand and also in Indonesia, and then some of them were pushed back out to sea. So it caused a big furor in Bangkok, and so one of our grantees there held several really big self-reflective conference where I happened to be there. So it was really interesting to see very defensive Thai authorities and, you know, military people who said, well, you know, we didn't really do that, and here's some pictures to show. Mm. So it was a very huge awareness raising. So again,
just for those who don't know, that's December 2008 when a boat with a couple of hundred Rohingya coming from Burma are stopped by the Thai military at sea and essentially sent off with some rice and water and told to look after themselves,
right.
Sort of following Berlusconi's policy to push people
right.
back to Libya. It's a problem not just in that area. And so this was the response.
Right. You know, there are not a lot of things you can do because, well, Burma hasn't signed many conventions on rights of people. So, but there's something called the International Human Rights Law. So thereby law, as a member of the UN, they're obligated not to do certain things and to do certain protection of people, regardless of whether they consider them stateless or not. Mm-hmm. So that also goes for the neighboring countries, so Malaysia, Thailand, the countries where some of the Rohingya are leaving, trying to flee to escape to. They cannot forcibly repatriate them. So we have instruments. So what we have to do is, I guess, you know, support regional NGOs who can stand up for them and make a lot of noise and keep it visible.
Because there's quite a few international organizations. Obviously, there's the UN, there's the ASEAN system and the new human rights mechanism within ASEAN. There's the ILO has been involved in trying to bring change on these issues, and there's a specific special rapporteur from the Human Rights Council just on the situation in Myanmar,
right.
as it's called
okay.
there. How useful are those in bringing attention and trying to create change?
Some yes, some no. So so far toothless ASEAN human rights mechanism, we're working on it, but it's basically just a lot of words right now. But the special rapporteur on human rights in Myanmar, Quintana, his latest report actually says the condition is so bad that he thinks it could be referred to the ICC. What was the other one you mentioned?
The ILO.
Oh, the ILO. The ILO is interesting because the ILO has been used in Burma in a way that actually made the government modify its behavior somewhat on forced labor. Mm. Of course, the Rohingyas are very, you know, vulnerable to this. So that's another way you can push. What they did was Burma's a party to the ILO. So you said, well, you're doing forced labor. And they said, no, we're not. Yes, you are. No, we're not. So finally, they threatened them to take them to the highest arbitration. And then all the members all around the world who belong to ILO can then reevaluate their relationship with Burma as a country, you know, for trade and all sorts of things. So they sort of buckled. So I'm not saying that everything is great, but they actually allow ILO to have an office there. But someone in the audience, a colleague of ours, Elena Berga, works for something called the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect. People know it as R2P, the Responsibility to Protect. So I'm just curious, because Ilana says yes, you know, R2P, yes for Rohingya, no for Thailand. So I just wondered if you would say a few words about if that as an instrument. Can you use, just come up to Richard.
Sure. The responsibility to protect is a concept that was agreed to at the World Summit in 2005, which was a gathering at the United Nations at the opening of the General Assembly there. And it is a concept that was agreed to by the entire UN membership, which includes Burma, and thus we don't have the problem that Maureen was talking about, that Burma hasn't subscribed to a lot of human rights instruments. They did agree to this, and what it says is that states have a responsibility to protect their own populations in the first instance, and then populations of other nations if states are manifestly failing to protect their own populations. And specifically what states have agreed to protect citizens from are four particular crimes, which are war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and genocide. And we would say that three out of these four crimes are occurring in Burma right now. War crimes, particularly in eastern Burma, where the government military, the Tatmadaw, is at war with a variety of armed militias there. Crimes against humanity happening across the country, including with the Rohingya. And then specifically applying only to the Rohingya would be ethnic cleansing. And that judgment is because of the fact that they're restricting marriages, restricting births, and similar policies to that. And so we would say that the government of Burma is clearly unwilling to protect its population and is therefore manifestly failing in its responsibility. So the international community has the obligation to take steps to protect the population of Burma, including the Rohingya. And policy options that should be considered to do that include everything from a commission of inquiry, as suggested by the Special Rapporteur on Myanmar in his most recent report, increased sanctions, global arms embargoes. In terms of, you know, sort of punishing measures, but also other forms of diplomatic engagement, which would involve the international community focusing specifically on the issue of the Rohingya and other ethnic minorities, as opposed to only the movement towards democracy, which gets a lot of press. But the responsibility to protect says that, you know, the international community needs to focus on the plight of the Rohingya and other groups.
Maureen, can I ask one last question?
Sure.
We've got elections coming up later
this year.
In Burma. To what extent is that making the situation worse, and to what extent is that an opportunity for further leverage?
Well, the worst is there's going to be a sham election, and there a lot of countries and with Burma fatigue will say, oh, wow, they had elections, and so at least they did that, and let's move on. The opportunity may be, but I'm not sure. It's strange. Well, maybe it's not strange, because the Burmese government has done this before, the military government. They want votes because they're not sure they're going to win if they do it fair and square. Funnily enough, they happen to have fair elections. That's why they lost the last one. So anyway, so they're going into Arakan, and especially among the Rohingya, they suddenly decided, I just read a thing, I think 60%, I mean, that's huge, 60% of the formerly non-ID people suddenly have IDs, so they can vote, for them, of course. And there's some businessmen, right, Rohingya businessmen close to the military regime who are running or urging them to vote for the regime's party. So the bad thing is, you know, all these, the military may think that they elected to stay forever, but the good thing is, I don't know how long the IDs last, but one certainly could do a lot of things. You can travel with the ID, you can buy things, you can do things that you weren't allowed to do. And maybe you could, I don't know, vote them out. Don't vote for that military party.
Interestingly enough, exactly the same happened in the Nubian community in Kenya. Well, they all suddenly got given IDs for an election because the MP for Kibera is the prime minister. But the problem is ID cards normally have a fixed expiry date, so suddenly it's no good a year later. So it causes great difficulty. All right, we've gone over slightly, but let's put it out to the audience. Can I ask that we'll take, to try and get as many questions in at once, we'll take them three at a time, if we may, and try and keep your questions as short as possible. If it goes over a minute, I might start interrupting you. And if you can come up to the microphone and ask a question there and say who you are and who you work from. And perhaps if the first three, there's a gentleman there, one was there. And do we have a third question for this first slot? One there as well.
My name is Bruce McInnes. My question really for Mr. Solomon. Considering how much is known through the work of organizations such as yours, how does the Bangladeshi government justify their behavior? Is it with the official, the unofficial, the disparity between the treatment of these people, where help is allowed and authorized and sanctioned, and then the great majority outside the official camps are ignored? How do they feel that if they don't provide help, people will not come? Are they afraid that if they do allow aid agencies to provide assistance, that'll just encourage greater immigration or migration? What is their justification? Thank you.
Thank you for that one. And we'll take the second question, if we may.
I do you want to come around? My name is Robert Chicona. I heard the term economic refugees bantered about, but it seems from the descriptions that the issue goes far beyond economic refugees, and I'm also heard a very brief mention of the ICC, but I wonder how persuasive or why is there no action, or that you have no one's addressed, I would know anyway, but if action at the ICC against the Burmese government, because it seems that the issue, I mean, is quite clearly within the realm of ICC jurisdiction.
It's the question of how real a threat is the ICC. There's some legal problems on that one, which we might address. And let's take the third question before we take some answers.
My name is Tim A. Hardy. Work with the Burma Global Action Network. My question is to Mount Tong Khan. I was just wondering your organizations. I know, you know, raising awareness about Rohingya situations and Burma.
Sure.
We're just wondering is there any strategies in terms of how to work and then collaborate with the, for example, the Arakanese people and the other ethnic groups, as well as the main dominant groups, you know, in terms of bringing change. Last comment, unfortunately, what you mentioned about 1986, the Dragon operation.
1978.
My uncle was one of the immigration officer that pretty much assigned to that region, Budiram Mondor. And I remember when I was growing up in Burma, like, he came back, and, you know, of course, because of the propagandas and stuff, that we have no idea what was going on at the time when I was quite young. And then, but so I'm just, you know, try to say that I'm sorry, and I just really unfortunate, because I remember pretty much, you know, detail that what happened during the, you know, within the family and everything.
I see.
And then he even brought back some of those clothing that were being donated by other international organizations, and you know, that's a lot of corruption and things that took place as well within my own family. So thank you for doing this.
Richard, do you want to start with the questions that you can deal
sure,
with?
Sure. The Bangladesh government takes a two-pronged approach. First, they deny. They deny that there are forced expulsions. Right after our report came out, the Prime Minister, the Minister of Foreign Affairs said that allegations of human rights abuses by the media and by human rights organizations were malicious and garbage. I think that reflects the foreign minister's views of what is taking place in the country. So denial. First point, they also say that I actually spoke with the ambassador to the United States in D.C. after our report came out. Certainly they were not pleased with our findings, but they did meet with us, and they said that, look, Bangladesh is a very poor country, and that if we start giving them humanitarian food aid or allow the international community to do so, it'll just open up the floodgates. And to my response to that is that there are no floodgates to open, because it is so difficult to actually get across the border. You know, things have really changed since the early 1990s, 20 years ago, when 250,000 people fled across. Burma, before the elections, Myanmar does not want to have a mass exodus. It's not going to happen. They're actually doing everything in their power right now in Arakan State to appease the Rohingya by giving out temporary cards, etc. So those are the two reasons that the government gives. I actually just read today that following our report a couple weeks later that the government has internally said that there will no longer be any forced expulsions. But again, that's just what they say. I spoke to my colleagues in Cox's Bazar this morning, and you know, dozens over the past a couple of weeks have been forcibly pushed back into Burma and are still being arbitrarily arrested. So,
do you want to you'd explain the fact that the report that you were initially doing was looking at gathering evidence for a potential war crimes prosecution. Obviously, we've got a problem with the ICC is that Burma hasn't signed the Rome Statute, and so the only way to get it before the court would be a Security Council referral, and that means that no one must veto it. Have you been thinking about that or been involved in some discussions on that question?
It's certainly part of our strategy once our data comes out. I mean, I think that it will be... I'm just getting data back now from Chin State, which we had 750 random surveys in every township in Chin State, and it's phenomenal results that we're getting back. We're going to easily show that crimes against humanity are widespread and systematic. What to do with this? What to do with this data? How do we use it as an advocacy tool? Well, it's up to we're going to be, working with ASEAN governments, Thailand and others, but India, China, and Russia, hold a lot of power. India and China, especially because of their economic trade with Myanmar, and China and Russia, of course, being on the Permanent Five on the Security Council, hold veto power, and as they've done before, they can veto Security Council a referral to the ICC, and that is expected. But let's not forget what happened with Darfur. There was an ICC referral for against al-Bashir, and that moved forward with two abstentions. So, anything is possible.
Maureen, have you got anything to add on that question?
Well, there's some indication that China's sort of sick of defending the pariah country all the time. So it behooves us to just keep the pressure on, so they have to keep defending it. And the other option is something called the Commission of Inquiry, which does not require a referral. So there are some campaigns about that. That is just look in, do an investigation, and that can be consigned by, pardon? By the Secretary General, but UNGA can also do it, right? Can the General Assembly also ask for it?
I believe so.
So anyway, there are various other entities that are not the UN Security Council who can ask for that.
So pressure can be built, but it's not an easy one, and the ICC's got enough difficult cases already, so they may not be entirely keen on it. Tun Kin, can we come to you on the question about using other groups to raise awareness on some of the problems that are occurring?
Well, thank you to Tim for asking me this question. It's a very good question. I'm really interested on it. And we really work in with all the democratic forces in UK, especially which is Burmese Democratic Movement Association and other ethnic groups, Karen, Kashin, Shan, and Arkanese. And we are together with all the ethnic people of Burma. We are working for the interests of future Federal Union of Burma. And we are also quite closely working, which is formed recently, Burma Initiative Group in UK, and they're all Arkanese, Rakhine, Kashin, Shan, Karen, all the ethnic groups are together there. So we hope we can work together to fight our main enemy, which is SPDC. So together we work, so there will be some hope for promoting human rights and democracy for Burma. Thank you.
Now, we had two questions that people had emailed in advance. So is Sarah Henderson here? You'd asked a question about the pushback. I don't know if you want to ask that one. If so, you can come and join the microphone. And I think Sabrina Gordon from Engage Media Project. Is Sabrina here? No. Well, I'll ask her question for her. But perhaps, Sarah, if you want to ask your question, and then let's have two others Any other questions? There's one there and one there. So that makes three.
I don't like to public speak, so...
You're going to delegate.
My colleague is going to talk.
It was an interesting one, which is why I picked you out for
thank
it.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're with Building Bridges to the Future Foundation that has been working in Aceh for 5 years. And you had brought this up before last February, two boatloads of Rohingya refugees that were allegedly dragged out to sea by the Thai military washed ashore in Aceh in a very poor area that, ironically, it used to be an area during their civil war with Indonesia where the Acehnese used to flee. They were refugees fleeing to Malaysia. And so these people saw these men coming ashore, very heartfelt, very little to give, but gave everything they could. And to the point earlier another question was asked is, these people aren't just stateless. They're also without international organizations. They're without NGOs. They seem to fall through the cracks. It's, you know, we went, our contact was recent, a year or something ago, and brief, about 6 months. And so my hat's off to you guys for fighting this battle for so long. But it's got to be horribly frustrating, as it was for us. These people had no food. We funded food through our own donors for 5 months, while at the same time we went to Washington to USAID, State Department, gave briefings there with PPM, PBM, and Capitol Hill. Finally, through work in Jakarta, we were able to find IOM, some help from them, and Human Rights Watch was very helpful, and USAID ended up being very supportive. But it took, you know, 8 months, I think, and then ultimately the whole camp was sort of swept under the rug, and overnight several people began disappearing, and more people began disappearing and just sort of evaporated. It was never addressed. ASEAN had a meeting at the time, Bali conference, that was formed to create, you know, to address these issues of human trafficking and human smuggling and the stateless people in Southeast Asia, didn't find it, you know, find this issue on their agenda for their conference. It's very frustrating, and we felt like it was perfect timing to sort of raise awareness of this issue, but there was a lot of Burma fatigue, there was Rohingya fatigue, and there was the fact that these refugees, I think, numbered in 400 between Sabang and East Aceh. And it was too small for anybody to worry about, but it was symbolic. And you know, our question was, how often is this going on?
Right. Sure. Maybe we'll come back. Let's just get the next question. There was someone there, yes.
Yeah. Hi, my name's Rachel Grundy. I'm not really with any organization. I'm just someone who's been interested
That's
in the cause of Burma for a long time. my question was, you were talking about how you had both talked about how there are there's the official and the unofficial camps, and in the official camps there is some access to elementary education. But my question is really, you know, access to education is something that is really important, I think, especially for women and for girls. And so what is there that can be done, or what needs to be done to start to give access to education for children, but particularly girls in both the official and the unofficial camps, to give them more opportunities? So that was my question. Thanks.
And we had a third one there.
My name is Amar Nguyen. I'm with the Burma Global Action Network. My question is to the photographer, Saifo Hak Obni. Sorry if I pronounced it wrong. My question is, why do you use black and white photography? Because, you know, in that region of the world, you know, like Muslim women, they wear, you know, very bright colors, very, you know, contrast that you can see, you know, like the horror and the colors, you know, like when you see photos from Darfur, you know, they are really amazing, you know, I mean, to promote those abuses, I think, you know, those photographies playing very good roles, and your photos are quite amazing, and that's my first question. And have you ever, when you were taking photographs, have you ever like witnessed any of, you know, abuses, you know, while you were there? If so, what kind of, you know, police?
Can you repeat the second question?
The second one?
Yeah.
Have you ever witnessed any abuses in the camp or, you know, when you were photographing? Okay,
great.
Thanks.
And I'm going to add that. That's a very good question. I nearly asked that one earlier, but we ran out of time. I'm going to add to that the question that was sent in, which builds on that, the type of photography one uses, and someone had asked the extent to which using these media and photographs is useful in a campaign. How much is it that it looks nice on the front of a brochure, and how much is it that it actually has an effect in persuading people that things should change? So, Omi, do you want to start dealing with those questions, perhaps?
Yeah. First of all, thank you for asking the question. Photography can make a difference. It is very evident. Every day you see images from around the world, but there are some images that remains in history. And in many times, the photography actually started the new discourse of many big events. It makes people think in a different way. So it is. It depends on the quality of the work, the integrity of the photographer, the ability of it. So yeah, photography can make a difference. And there are many kinds of photography, and there is one sort of photography which doesn't end in the frame itself, as we say. It takes you beyond. It makes you think. It makes you question the situation. It makes you ask questions, and that's where it can play a big role. And about the use of black and white, I think it's my way of looking at life, so to speak. Darfur was documented both in color and both in black and white. Many great masters of photography still now and will be in working in black and white. I personally think with the kind of work most of the time that I'm doing, my fear is color itself is a subject. Color itself is a content that takes the image to some certain directions. With my kind of work, I sometimes felt that I'm losing control because I try to be very focused on my story. I want to control what I want to say, and think about any of the images here. Think about the first image that I talked about. Think about the man, it's in color, the man wearing the red shirt. It would be the red shirt that would take all the attention, not the story. I'm not talking is color photography, I do it myself, but the kind of work that I produce, I want to control the situation, so that helps. Yeah.
Have you seen the abuses? He also asked.
Yeah, the next question. I have seen it with my eyes, and that is what I was trying to tell. The situation there is very horrible, and in one incident in particular, I followed a lot of stories. I mean, a lot of violence and rapes and violence against women, gang fights, and many things. So I was photographing in the Kutupalong camp, and suddenly I hear a woman screaming not far from where I was. Then I ran into her place and saw something horrible. She was having a fight with someone, with a neighbor, and it was a man that she was having the fight with. The man actually grabbed her ear and literally pulled it out. Literally, it was in his hand, half of it. So that's what I saw. I mean, that's what happens inside the camps. It's horrible. Yeah, I've seen it.
Richard, can you perhaps follow up on that question and the one about education? Camps, we know refugee camps have particular problems with gender-based violence and other issues that affect women in particular. And the questioner has raised the particular point about education and how that disproportionately affects girls and women. From your study, was there a particular gender-based issues that came up as a result of your questioning?
Thanks. It's a great question. It's troubling, though, as well, because we certainly know that education is can change a girl's or boy's life just having 5 years of education. It's well documented in development studies. But I think it's important to realize that, and this is what's hard to imagine, because the humanitarian community is so infrequently denied access to populations, and that's what's going on in Bangladesh. So these people, the unofficial refugees, not the 28,000 who do enjoy some sort of education, who do have access to rice, etc., but the other tens of thousands who are denied this, they're not even getting food. So to talk about education in the unofficial camp, it's a bit unrealistic at this point. Also, you have to remember the Bangladesh government does not want, it believes that even giving a cup of rice to a family will create a situation where hundreds of thousands of more refugees will come in. So can you imagine what their thought of, like, all of a sudden supplying or giving education to these people? So it is a bit of a non-starter. In terms of human rights violations, I just want to point out that just very simplistically, we have rights of, or violations of commission and violations of omission. And I see violations of omission, in other words, the government is not doing something, all the time. You look at malnutrition, and that's a violation of omission. The government is not providing food or is literally blocking humanitarian access. It's harder to catch acts of commission, flagrant délit in French, you know, while the act is happening. And that's where photography can play it's an amazing tool. I actually had a photojournalist with me in Shan State in Burma, where I just came back from yesterday, and she took 40 hours of film, and she's a professional film producer, and I just can't wait to see the footage, because it is really going to tell a completely different story than just, you know, my 50-page report with a bunch of footnotes. So I'm really excited about using photography and video, especially by professionals. But we also gave out small flip cameras to some of our surveyors, who are really excited to, you know, take this back with them inside Burma. Granted, they're risking their life in doing so, but we're going to get footage back from them.
And I don't know if you want to add something on the question on the lack of reaction to the Aceh incident and the other pushbacks. Mm-hmm. How come there wasn't more international pressure on those specific incidents? Why wasn't it such a big news story that it should have been globally?
You mean about boat people? Or
yeah.
Well, this is, I think, international community should collaborate with ASEAN countries, especially Thailand, Malaysia, and also Bangladesh. They collaborate and they have to push they have to persuade to the regime, and US, UK, European countries, they have to put pressure to the regime to find out the political solution. And this is not enough, and the regime is getting more harder to the Rohingya people. So I think the international community pressure is not enough. They should find out the permanent solution for the Rohingya problem, because of 1.5 million have been left out of the country. These stateless people are everywhere in the world. So as it is international community to protect Rohingya people, and to find out the permanent solution for the Rohingya refugees, the like US, UK, European countries need to push to the regime to find, to restore the citizenship of Rohingya, and to lift up all the restriction and to find out a political solution for to give the rights as same as other ethnic and nationalities of Burma. That's what I believe international community should do.
Thank you. You had another point?
Yeah, as we are talking a lot about Bangladesh, and I'm from Bangladesh, I think I should say something. Yeah. First of all, the situation that he was mentioning, I've started working just a year ago. So I heard in between those years, between like 2001 to 2007, things were not that bad. It went pretty bad in the last few months for some reason. I have talked to a few people, and he was mentioning about a member of the parliament. His name is Mr. Bodhi, and sorry to mention his name, but he is on newspaper everywhere. He is a guy who, I think, I would not say that he represents the entire Bangladesh. He is not liked by anyone, not even the Prime Minister, not even by her party. So that does not represent Bangladesh, first. Second is the question of education. Recently, a few months ago or a year ago, UNHCR was allowed to set up schools, primary schools, within the camp, and I have worked there, and I have photographed that. And what is happening there, Rohingya children who are called the self-settled, right? Rohingyas, unregistered Rohingyas, who has been living there for many, many years, 15 years, 12 years, 20 years, they are living in the villages. So their parents, mother or father works, though they are not earning a lot of money, but their children are going to schools, not in numbers, that's for sure. So officially they are not allowed, but unofficially they are going. I have been to one or two families, especially I photographed one rickshaw puller who lives in Teknaf. He has been living there for the last 35 years or something. He was like 10 years old when he came to Bangladesh. Now he has a family. Both of her child are going to schools. About giving foods and supplies, the fear from Bangladeshi government part is if they have a better life here in Bangladesh than Burma, then the rest of the Rohingyas would definitely come here. And I am not defending what is happening, but I'm just trying to make one point that Bangladesh is one of the poorest country in the world. The number of people living in one square kilometer in Bangladesh now is 1,200, where it is probably 30 people here in the US. So 50% of the people or 60% of the people are living below the poverty line. Rohingyas are getting works. If they are not getting foods, they would have all died by now. They're getting foods because they're earning it. I mean, they're working. What happens, like, if a Bangladeshi person works a day, he would earn, say, $3 a day. If the ones who are giving works to others, laborers and things, knows that he or she is a Rohingya, they would definitely pay half of it. I mean, $1.5 a day. So the life is pretty hard, but it's not okay. But it's not that they're all... I have been working there. I was on the ground. I'm still working there. So that's the scenario. What happened in last 3 months, I would say, 2-3 months, I've heard very difficult stories. Like the guy that I was working with, Abul Qasim, my guide, that the photographer that you have just seen. I waited 3 days in the hotel in Cox's Bazar, where I stay. But he couldn't come to my hotel, and we were supposed to start working with the unregistered Rohingyas, so he had to come to Cox's Bazar. As he was mentioning, the Kutupalung camp and the other camps are like 1 hour drive from the Cox's Bazar. He couldn't come because he was very afraid of getting arrested. So nobody knows who would get arrested and things. The reason behind all this, I'm not so very sure whether it is the decision from the high up of the government or the decision came from the very local government, like the local MP or the DC, the district judge and things. I don't know. I cannot say that it is the decision by the government of Bangladesh. I don't think it is like that. But what happened, they knew that it's happening and they allowed it to happen. And as I said in the beginning of my speech, that they need a scapegoat. Rohingyas are the scapegoat. And the second reason is they think in a way that if these stories gets out, if the people, you know, Myanmar, the border is very near to Cox's Bazar, so they can use the mobile phone. It's the same network. So what happens, whenever something happens here, they gave a call to their home or they call them back. So this news goes there that people are getting beaten, arrested, and things like that. So it stops the flow of Rohingyas for some time. And then this is the way they're thinking. That's it.
It seems likely that it's been difficult for the last 3 months, and with the election coming up, the situation needs to be closely watched for the next few months as well.
The election is over.
In the Burmese
election, yeah.
And if I can come back to the question that was asked about statelessness, and one of the key problems with statelessness is they don't, by very definition, have a voice. They have no democratic representation or anything such as that. Legal protection for statelessness is very weak. There's a 1951 convention and a 54 convention and a 64 convention to protect the rights of stateless people, but no one has signed those conventions. There's an annual resolution from the Human Rights Council, which we are involved in advocating to develop the rights that are protected in that, but it's very difficult. And one of the reasons why the Justice Initiative has chosen to engage on the question of statelessness is essentially because no one else is doing it. It's a long-term project that involves putting in 4 to 7 years of commitment in order to take these cases forward. But we do currently have two cases, one for the Inter-American Court, one for the Commission, which we filed on Tuesday, 2 cases for the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, one for the African Committee on the Rights and Welfare of the Child, 3 cases in the European Court of Human Rights, and a case before the UN Human Rights Committee, trying to develop the legal standards on statelessness so that they can be used in the future. Now, we've gone over time, but I can see that the barman is still here, which means that we're not going to be thrown out in the immediate future. Is that right? I think we've got a bit of time. So if people have additional questions, please come forward and ask the panel, who will be here for a little while longer. But I'm afraid we need to bring it to a close now. So can I ask you to thank our panel for their time.